Right now, it's 10 o'clock, so it's drama. And to start the week, the first of our three-part adaptation of the John Fowles classic, The French Lieutenant's Woman.
Stretching eyes west over the sea, wind foul or fair, always stood she, prospect impressed. Solely out there did her gaze rest, never elsewhere seemed charm to be. A person of curiosity could have at once deduced several strong possibilities about the pair who began to walk down the quay at Lyme Regis. The Cob, as it is commonly known, one morning in late March of 1867, and into a sharp easterly wind, the most disagreeable wind to suffer in Lyme Bay.
My dear Tina, we have paid our homage to Neptune. I am sure he will forgive us if we now turn our backs on him.
No, Charles. I wish to walk to the end.
Then we shall walk to the end.
Our local spy, and there was one, might have deduced that these two were strangers to the town, people of a very superior taste as regards their outward appearance. The young lady was dressed in the height of fashion. The taller man, impeccable in a light grey suit, with his top hat held in his free hand, had severely reduced his dun drearies, which fashion had declared a shade vulgar a year or two previously.
Charles, I wish to hear what passed between you and Papa last Thursday.
Your aunt has already extracted every detail of that pleasant evening
from
me.
Charles, I have had a letter from Mama.
I feared you might.
Something happened, did it not, over the port?
Your father ventured the opinion that Mr. Darwin should be exhibited in a cage in the Zoological Gardens monkey house. I tried to explain some of the scientific arguments behind the Darwinian position. As a scientist of a sort myself, respectfully, of course, I was unsuccessful.
Which means you are at your most hateful.
He did say that he would not let his daughter marry a man who considered his grandfather to be an ape. I think on reflection he will recall that in my case it was a titled ape.
Meaning my grandfather was a small draper and yours a baronet.
And neither was an ape. Dearest Tina, it is perfectly proper that you should be afraid of your father, but I am not marrying him.
I hope you did not tell him that. But Charles, come here. These are the very steps that Jane Austen made Louisa Musgrove fall down in Persuasion. Charles? What is it?
Well, that figure at the quay's end. Can you see?
You know my eyesight. Only a shape.
I took it to be a fisherman, but I believe it is a woman.
If it is a woman, I can guess who it is.
Oh, who?
It must be poor Tragedy.
Tragedy?
A nickname. The fishermen have a different name for her.
What is that?
The French Lieutenant's Woman.
Indeed. And is she so ostracized that she has to spend her days out here?
She's a little mad, they say.
Who was this French lieutenant?
A man she's said to have
fallen in love with.
Worse than that.
Oh. And he abandoned her. What is she doing out there?
They say she waits for his return.
Has she no one to care for her?
She's a servant of some sort to Mrs. Pulteney.
I would like a look at her.
I do not like to be near her.
If she's rings on you, I shall defend you. So come.
So they went slowly closer to the figure by the cannon bollard at the Cob's end. They saw, or Charles saw, for Ernestina did not look, that she had taken off her bonnet and held it in one hand, the other holding on to the bollard. Her hair was pulled tight back inside the collar of her black coat. The danger of the position did not seem to concern her. Her stare was aimed like a rifle at the farthest horizon. There came a stronger gust of wind which made the woman cling more firmly to the bollard. Then, just as suddenly, the wind dropped.
My good woman, we cannot see you here without being alarmed for your safety. A stronger squall and...
He stopped speaking as she turned to look at him. Or, as it seemed to Charles, through him. She was young, but it was an unforgettable face, and a tragic face. He saw no artifice there, no hysteria. It was no mask. And above all, there was no sign of madness. The madness was in the empty sea, the empty horizon.
She's Mrs. Pulteney's companion, Charles. A recent post there.
Thank you. Mrs. Pulteney?
Oh, she has a large establishment, a Marlborough House. It's on a hill overlooking the bay.
We visit on occasions, do we not, Aunt? Mm.
And Mrs. Pulteney is sure to know that Charles has joined you here, Ernestina, so he must come back with us on our next invitation. Do you agree?
Oh, yes, Aunt. It will be very good for him.
Aunt Tranter, What is there that I should know about this lady, Mrs. Pulteney?
She has very fixed views on most subjects. Her servants do not stay for long. The last butler but four told her, I gather, that he would rather spend the rest of his life in the poorhouse than live another week under her roof.
But poor tragedy lives under her roof.
Her name is Sarah Woodruff. Her history is a difficult one to explain, Charles. The Vicar of Lyme got her the place. What Mrs. Pulteney knows of her background, I have no idea.
I couldn't bring myself to look at her. Did she seem mad to you, Charles?
She has a tragic face, indeed, but she is not mad.
The next time we visit Mrs. Pulteney, Ernestina, I am sure Sarah Woodruff will be in our company.
She must have a reason for taking employment with Mrs. Pulteney, Aunt Tranter.
Yes, but what reason? I have no idea, Charles.
Why was Sarah Woodruff prepared to subject herself to the tyranny of Mrs. Pulteney and the lesser but spiteful tyranny of the housekeeper, Mrs. Fairley? Both women, by all accounts, incipient sadists. There were two simple reasons. Marlborough House commanded a magnificent prospect of Lyme Bay, and secondly, she had exactly 7 pence in the world. When we first met her on the cob, gazing so steadfastly at the horizon and then startling Charles, she had been at Marlborough House for a year, and she had brought about a happier domestic atmosphere. To jump a century or so, Sarah had been born with a computer in her heart. It gave her an instinctive intelligence, an uncanny ability to understand other people's worth in the fullest sense of that word. She saw them as they were and not as they tried to seem. Hence, she soon twigged Mrs. Pulteney.
And this we should not tolerate in the Church of England churches. I remain yours sincerely. Read it back, Miss Woodruff.
My dear Lord Bishop, you may have seen an item in today's...
Yes, come in.
Come on. Come on.
Ah, Mrs. Fairley. So?
This is the culprit, ma'am. Millie. Can't you stop that, my girl?
The ferns in the drawing-room, girl. You omitted to water them on Tuesday.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
You may well be. Has she not forgotten other duties this last 2 weeks, Mrs. Fairley?
She has, ma'am. Last Thursday she did not dust the ornaments in the ante-room, and 2 days ago she did not light the fire in your drawing-room at the time laid down. Stop that, girl.
I'll tolerate much, but I will not tolerate this.
I'll not do it again, Mom.
You will most certainly never do it again in my house.
Oh, Mom, please.
Mrs. Fairley will give you your wages.
Stop that noise, girl. Out you come. Come on.
I can't,
come on.
Mom, I can't.
Excuse me, Mrs. Pulteney. What is it, Millie? Are you quite well?
No, Miss Sarah. I'm not.
What has been your trouble, Millie? Tell me.
Her trouble, eh?
Please, Mrs. Fairley. What is your trouble, Millie?
I keeps on fainting. All sudden-like.
Let me feel your brow.
Her brow is burning, Mrs. Pulteney. She is not pretending, I am sure, ma'am.
No. Fainting? What makes her faint?
I do not know, ma'am, but it could be serious. You can see, ma'am, how she looks. She could be quite ill.
Yes, I can see. What am I to do? What do you say?
I think she should be put to bed, ma'am, and the doctor be called.
Yes, of course. See, Dr. Grogan is summoned, Mrs. Fairley.
Yes, ma'am, if you say so. But, Doc,
may I help her up to her bed, ma'am?
Yes, if you think that is best.
Let us get you on your feet, Lily.
Hold on to me.
Thank you, ma'am.
Now, Mrs. Pulteney seldom went out and never on foot, so she relied upon Mrs. Fairley for news of what was going on in Lyme, and in particular for news of Sarah's activities on her two afternoons off. On the afternoon Charles and Ernestina had seen Sarah on the cob, so had Mrs. Fairley, and not for the first time. She told her employer that Sarah was looking out to sea for Satan's sails. Mrs. Pulteney, in reprimanding Sarah for this strange behaviour, suggested she should walk elsewhere. So it was that Sarah found Ware Commons, and Charles was about to do so. He was staying a short walk from Aunt Tranter's house, where Ernestina was staying until her marriage to Charles at the end of June, at the White Lion, with his manservant, Sam.
Morning, Mr. Charles. It's a fine day.
Oh, is it, Sam? Oh, fine, you say. By Jove, Sam, it's more than fine. Open the window, will you?
That's a blooming sheep making a row, Sam.
Oh, upon my word, Sam. Oh, on a day like this, I could contemplate never setting eyes on London again.
If you go just standing in the cold air, you won't neither, sir.
Sam, you've been drinking again.
No, sir. Not a drop has passed my lips.
Quod est demonstrandum, you have the hump on a morning that would make a miser sing, ergo you have been drinking.
No, sir. Truth is, sir, it's that there kitchen girl and Miss Tranter's.
Explain yourself.
Well, I sees her down out there in the street and she calls to me.
What did she call, pray?
She calls, have you got a bag of soot, sir?
She must have guessed you're a London-born man.
Bloomin' milkmaid.
Yes, I think I know the maid. She's the one in the grey dress, And she's far from ugly.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah. Well, shut out them bar lambs. She has the look, sir, and a tongue. I mean, it's the humiliation, sir. I mean, all the ostlers heard.
All the ostlers?
Yeah.
Two to be exact, I believe, and one of them is stone deaf.
Well, but she shouldn't have said it. Are you going to Miss Trenton's today, sir?
Yes, and by 10. You can come and ask that saucy milkmaid what she meant by the bag of soot.
I shall have, Caesar.
You will. Now pour some water and I'll shave myself today. Then get me my breakfast, there's a good fellow. Oh, and let me have a double dose of muffins.
Yes, sir.
With Sam gone, Charles stared at his face in the mirror. He had time to kill. The supposed great misery of this century is the lack of time, and we devote a great deal of ingenuity and income to find faster ways of doing things. But for the 32-year-old Charles and for his social peers, the time signature over existence was firmly adagio. And if one of the commonest symptoms of wealth today is destructive neurosis, in Charles' century it was tranquil boredom, which is all he could look forward to at Aunt Tranter's in an hour or so.
Boy, bought this for you, sir. Came from Miss Tranter's.
Thank you.
Oh, Miss Ernestina is unwell, Sam.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Charles. Nothing serious, I hope.
No, not at all serious. You might buy some flowers and take them to Miss Tranter's for the invalid. And you have my permission to proffer a blossom of your own to the young lady at the house who is so hostile to soot.
That's kind of you, sir. I might consider doing it.
You will. Here's a crown. I'm going fossil hunting, so you may take the day off.
Oh, thank you, sir. And you look after yourself, sir.
One way, the most important way, by which Charles filled in time was paleontology. And there was nowhere better that he knew of to carry out his scientific studies than Lyme Regis. So, as soon as he could, he set out for the beach under Ware Cleeves. He would have made you smile, for he was carefully equipped for his role. How, one wonders today, can he not have seen that light clothes would have been more comfortable, that a hat was not necessary, and that stout nailed boots on a boulder-strewn beach are as suitable as ice skates? However, so dressed, he worked his way steadily along the beach for a couple of hours, and discovered, when he went to turn back for home, that the tide had cut off his retreat that way. There was nothing for it but to take the steep path up the cliff.
Oh, quite a climb indeed. But here we are, above the world. Take a breather, I think. And what is this place? A Garden of Eden, if ever there was. Oh, look at it. Does no one come here? Has it been forgotten?
Not forgotten, but ignored. And inaccessible was the undercliff wilderness that Charles had found, and whose eastern half was called Ware Commons. This strip of land, a mile-long slope caused by the erosion of the ancient vertical cliff face and tilted towards the sun, with water from the countless springs, gave the area a botanical strangeness. In summer, it is the nearest this country can offer to a tropical jungle. And now, in late March, once Charles had quenched his thirst and cooled his brow, the prospect before him, the sounds, the scents, the unalloyed wilderness and bursting fertility, forced him into an unscientific mood.
By Jove, the ground is studded gold. Jove himself must have made this. There's also celandines, white slow in blossom, and 100 primroses. What can't I find in this enchanted garden? Birds view me with interest, not fear. What is this they sing? What is it indeed? Oh, I must head for home. Go east, young man, back to Lyme.
Charles found a path of sorts which climbed and curved beside an ivy-grown wall and went up a steep small slope crowned with grass to a little green plateau, like a tiny alpine meadow. He stood for a moment in the sunlight, taking in the beauty of his surroundings. Then something made him move to the edge of the plateau.
Oh, good God, is it a body? Someone fallen? Lost? Grasses are so thick, it's hard to tell, but I think it's a girl sleeping. Or dead. Is she alive? Who is it? Is it the girl on the cot? The French lieutenant's woman? Yes, it must be. Oh, damn.
What is it? Who are you? Who are you, sir?
A thousand apologies. I came upon you inadvertently.
I fell asleep.
My apologies again.
It's not your fault, sir.
You have found a perfect eyrie in this lovely wilderness.
It is something I am good at.
I will leave you to your rest. Good afternoon.
As Sarah watched him vanish into the shadows of the undercliff, she realized he was the same man she had seen that previous afternoon on the cob. And something in her nature told her that he was subtly different from most men.
All right, I'm coming.
Sam Farrow, at your service, Miss Mary.
I see you, Tiz. And whose foot is in the door?
Well, I always take cautions. Flowers for the beautiful young lady upstairs from Mr. Charles.
Oh, they'd be lovely. I'll take them up.
And here, these is for the even more lovely one down here.
I thank you, Sam Farrow.
And that there bag of soot will be delivered as ordered. On one condition, no tick. It must be paid for at once.
How much would it cost, then?
Well, we'll have to see, won't we?
Of the three young women who passed through this radio serial, Mary is, in my opinion, by far the prettiest. She is infinitely the most life and infinitely the least selfishness. She also has an exquisitely pure complexion, corn-coloured hair, and delectable wide grey-blue eyes. And not even the sad Victorian clothes can hide the trim, rondelay promise of her figure.
Flowers from Mr. Charles, Miss Tina.
With compliments.
Place them on my dressing table.
Yes, miss.
Did Mr. Charles bring them himself?
No, miss. His man did.
Where is Mr. Charles?
Don't know, miss.
Then what did you speak to his man about?
Oh, just the time of day, miss.
And was that which made you laugh?
'Tis the way he speaks, miss.
Mr. Smithson has spoken to me of him. He comes from London, remember? And he fancies himself as a Don Juan.
What's a Don Juan, miss, please?
Never mind. But if he makes advances, I wish to be told at once. Do you understand?
Yes, miss. Advances.
So, we don't know where Mr. Charles is. Now, bring me some barley water, will you?
Charles was putting his best foot forward, and thoughts of the mysterious young woman behind him. He went through the woods of Ware Commons and came to the first outpost of civilization, a long thatched cottage, with two or three meadows round it and a man hoying a herd of cows. There slipped into his mind at this scene an image of a delicious cool bowl of milk. He went to the long cottage and slaked his thirst.
Oh, that is better. Thank you. What do I owe you?
One penny, sir.
Thank you. Well, I'll be on my way. Good day to you. There is a young lady on the path above your meadow. Do you know her?
What young lady?
Come and see for yourself. Do you know her?
Aye, I knows her.
Does she come this way often?
Often enough. And she bain't no lady. She be the French lieutenant's whore.
Is that what you call her? Well, I shall attempt to catch her up.
She don't speak to no one. Do you no good?
Madam. Madam. I hope to catch you up.
And you have, sir.
I owe you two apologies. I did not know when I saw you on the cob that you were Mrs. Poultner's companion and secretary. I fear I addressed you in a most impolite manner.
I don't remember, but it is no matter, sir.
And just now, when I must have seemed intrusive.
It is no matter. I understood.
You see, I thought you... I was afraid lest you had been taken ill.
No, I am quite well, thank you, sir.
Since we both walk in the same direction, may I not accompany you?
No. Thank you, but I prefer to walk alone.
It was Miss Trent who made me aware of my error. I have not introduced myself. I am Charles
Smith. I know who you are, sir.
Then can we not walk together?
I know also why you are in line, sir.
Yes, I am sure it is common knowledge, but I just want
kindly to... Kindly allow me to go on my way alone. And please tell no one you have seen me here.
She tells me in her eyes, do not come near me, do not touch me. Is that the truth? Or does she feign her affections? And those eyes.
Mrs. Poultney? You seem troubled, ma'am. Is there anything wrong?
Something is very wrong.
What is very wrong, ma'am?
I have been told something I can hardly believe.
Is it to do with me?
You're a cunning, wicked creature.
Why do you think that, ma'am? Why?
Why? You know very well why.
I do not. I must insist on knowing of what I am accused.
Ware Commons! Mrs. Fairley has reported to me that you've been seen walking on Ware Commons.
What is the sin in walking on Ware Commons?
You? A young woman alone in such a place?
It is nothing but a large wood, and I was not alone if Mrs. Fairley saw me.
It is Sodom and Gomorrah! Mrs. Fairley would not enter such a place. What French abominations go on there, I dare not think. What sort of person frequents it, I dare not say.
There is nothing there, ma'am, and no one frequents it. I go there to be alone.
You dare to contradict me, miss?
Do not you see? I do not understand you.
I have made myself quite clear, have I not, miss?
There is nothing there. It is a wilderness. No one goes there but myself. I go there because I am not to go to the seashore or the cob. I wish for solitude, that is all. That is not a sin. I will not be called a sinner for that.
Have you never heard speak of Ware Commons?
I have heard nothing of Ware Commons since I have been in Lyme. No one has ever mentioned it to me.
Very well. I believe you. But let it be plainly understood, I permit no one in my employ to go or to be seen near the place. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, very clear, ma'am.
Will you in future confine your walks to where it is seemly to walk?
I will find the paths of righteousness to walk on, ma'am.
Charles, you shall not get a drop of tea until you've accounted for every moment of your day.
Every moment, my dear Tina. Impossible, time went so quickly.
Did it? Without me?
Oh, I'm teasing you, my dearest. But you see, finding my old fossils, as you call them, does somehow make the time pass faster than one can imagine.
So, you found some old fossils. And what else did you get up to, pray?
Well, I found the Undercliff. A most fascinating wilderness, Tina. A place of luxuriant growth, of wonderful wild flowers, of trees that... some of a kind I have not seen before, and a host of singing birds. Now, I had no idea such a place could exist in England. It is, my dearest, more like a tropical jungle than anything.
Why, Charles, you sound quite tranced.
Well, the place held a sort of enchantment, yes.
And did you find wood nymphs to dally with?
No, but no one has been there for years, I swear.
I think you now deserve some tea.
Later that night, Sarah might have been seen by a passing owl standing at the open window of her unlit bedroom, her face wet with silent tears. The town was dark. Out on the black waters, a distant lantern winked faintly from some ship sailing towards Bridport. She saw it and did not give it a second thought. This staring out to sea was not part of her mysterious vigil for Satan's sails, but a preliminary to jumping from the window. But no, she did not kill herself, and she continued to haunt Ware Commons. So, in a way, she had jumped and was living a long fall.
To go, Charles, don't we, Aunt?
I could make our excuses, but Mrs. Pulteney may not accept them, of course.
And you can entertain her with an account of your adventure yesterday in the... where was it?
The Undercliff.
You came back through Ware Commons, I presume. By a farmhouse just before Lyme?
I did, Aunt Tranter, and I had a penneth of milk there.
Whatever you do, Charles, don't breathe a word of Ware Commons to Mrs. Pulteney.
No, of course not. But why? What is the mystery?
Does the place hold some unfortunate memory for her?
Nothing of the sort. She simply believes it is a place of infamy.
And is it?
Of course not. In the summer, couples from the lower classes walk there. That is all. But Mrs. Pulteney forbids any of her staff to set foot on the commons.
How does she know? Does she have her spies there?
She has her spy, Charles. And those who will gossip.
Why does she believe these commons are so awful, that things take place there?
I do not know, Ernestina. It is a delusion, for sure, but how it came about, I do not know. I only know it would be better if Charles refrained from mentioning his visit.
The cause of Mrs. Pulteney's delusion over Ware Commons was opium. She was an opium addict, although she did not know it. For what we call opium, she called laudanum. Our laudanum, as Dr. Grogan called it, helped many a 19th-century lady, and less, to get through the black night of womanhood. But it gave vivid dreams. So Mrs. Pulteney had built up a Bosch-like dream picture of Ware Commons that she took for real. Albeit why this was so, it is better that we do not inquire.
My dear Mrs. Pulteney.
My dear Miss Trentard.
You remember my niece, Ernestina?
How are you, Mrs. Pulteney? You look exceedingly well.
At my age, Ernestina, spiritual health is all that counts. Oh,
then I have no fears for you. And allow me to present my fiancé, Mr. Smithson.
Great pleasure, ma'am. Charming house.
My companion, Miss Woodruff.
Oh, my dear Miss Woodruff, it is a pleasure to see you.
Miss Tranter, how are you?
It is only Sarah's presence which makes this tea party interesting, and she only spoke, and briefly, if spoken to. Charles, of course, was intrigued to see how the wild creature would behave in these barred surroundings, and was disappointed at first to see it was with utter meekness. Then, towards the end of the visit, it became clear to him Sarah was playing a part to perfection. And that part was one of complete disassociation from and disapprobation of her mistress. He only came awake from his contemplation of Sarah's role-playing when he heard the name of Aunt Tranter's servant, Mary, mentioned.
Mrs. Fairley informs me that she saw her only this morning, talking with a person, a young person, who Mrs. Fairley did not know.
A young male person, Mrs. Pulteney?
A young male person, Mr. Smithson.
Then no doubt it was Sam. He is my servant, ma'am.
I meant to tell you, Charles. I saw them talking together yesterday.
But surely, my dearest, they can speak together. What harm is there in that?
Oh, Charles, there is a world of difference between Sam's London and here. I think you should speak to him.
Well, he must be allowed some private life.
Let your future wife be the judge of such matters, Mr. Smithson.
Do you think so, madam? Where can I draw the line?
I know the girl in question. I had to dismiss her.
Well, she is a very pretty, vivacious girl, is she not, Miss Tranter?
Mary is one of the...
If you were older, Mr. Smithson, you would know that one cannot be too strict in such matters.
I bow to your far greater experience, madam.
The three ladies all sat with averted eyes. Sarah may have fleetingly smiled at Charles's cold and sarcastic tone. Then a look, unseen by these ladies, did at last pass between Sarah and Charles. It was very brief, but it spoke worlds. Two strangers had recognized they shared a common enemy.
Are you sure, Sam, that you wouldn't like to return to London?
No, Mr. Charles. I'm happy here.
It is being said that you're up to no good. When I explained that it was your natural behaviour, I was told that I wasn't old enough to know what I was talking about.
That's a blooming liberty to say, sir. Well, I haven't done a thing that's no good, sir.
You've been talking to that very pretty maid of Miss Tranter's. What say you to that?
Well, true enough, sir, we have spoken.
I thought she had humiliated you regarding a bag of soot.
Well, we came to an understanding about that, Mr. Charles. Will you be having supper here tonight, sir?
Don't change the subject. This girl, Mary, is a bright, charming girl, Sam. But I've been told she is a gentle, trusting creature at heart. And I would not have that heart broken.
Well, I'm the one with the heart in danger, sir.
Ooh, so you mean that you are serious?
Cut off my arms if I'm not, sir.
Oh, I believe you. I apologise.
Thank you, sir. I'm a Derby duck, though, sir.
Already cooked, are you? Beyond who?
That's it, sir. I'm a Derby duck at her mercy.
5 uneventful days passed. And then on the 6th day, Ernestina granted him an afternoon for his wretched grubbing among stones. He knew at once where he wished to go. He had no thought except for Sarah when he first saw her on that wild cliff meadow. But he had just had previous time to notice, at the foot of a little bluff, considerable piles of fallen flint. When he came to where he had to scramble up through the brambles, she came sharply to mind again, and there, a dark movement, and it was her, halfway up the steep little path. Too occupied in disengaging her coat from a recalcitrant bramble to hear his turf-silenced approach.
Miss Woodruff.
Mr. Smithson.
Allow me. You are well and truly caught.
Thank you, sir. I must be on my way.
Oh,
me help you?
Thank you, but I'm all right.
Your ankle is not turned at all.
No, I'm not hurt.
I dread to think what would happen if you should one day turn an ankle.
It would not matter, Mr. Smithson.
It certainly would matter. I have been told of Mrs. Pulteney's strange views on this place, and that she forbids you to set foot here.
She has been told I come here. Now I must return. So if you would allow me...
Will you permit me to say something first? Miss Woodruff, I cannot pretend that your circumstances have not been discussed in front of me. Miss Tranter knows you are not happy at Marlborough House.
No, you could be. But does it matter?
Miss Woodruff, no one is beyond help.
I am.
I doubt it, but you inspire sympathy.
Thank you.
I think you should leave Lyme. I understand you have excellent qualifications. I could have inquiries made in London, for instance.
I cannot leave this place, however hateful it is to me.
Then all I can do is apologize for intruding yet again on your privacy. Good day.
Mr. Smithson! To be spoken to as if I am not the Scarlet Woman of Lyme is kind of you. I am most grateful, but such kindness, you see.
Such kindness is what?
Such kindness is crueler to me than what you know.
Let me be frank. I have heard it said that you are not altogether sound of mind. I think that is untrue.
Yes. I am not mad.
But you have surely judged yourself too severely for your past conduct.
Have I?
Yes, you are young. You are able to gain your living. You have no family ties, I believe.
I have ties.
You mean to this French lieutenant?
Who else? But I do not wish to speak of him.
But you must. He is like a wound, and the wound festers if paid no attention to. If he does not return, he was not worthy of you.
He will never return.
You fear he will never return?
I know he will never return.
Why are you so sure?
It is simple. He is married.
That evening, Charles found himself seated between Miss Tranter and Ernestina in the assembly room of Lyme for a concert. He felt decidedly guilty and puzzled.
Look at them, Charles. What a lot of gooseberries. What frumps. Oh, dresses. You'd hardly call them fashionable. She's a soprano. Who is she? Madame Maud Birdwood. I hope she can sing like a bird in a wood. The pianist is Signor Ritonello. Do you think he's really Italian? Here we go.
Tina is in a mischievous mood, which is mildly irritating. I have to respond, smile. That strange girl, Sarah. After she had gone, why did I feel guilty? I ought to cut and run where she's concerned. But she attracts me, and she's like no other woman I've known. Am I being stupid? Yes. I should have told Tina about her, but it's too late now. Tina is pretty, charming, vapid, selfish. But as a spoilt, rich little girl, how could she be other than vapid and selfish? I've done the obvious conventional thing, becoming engaged to such a girl. But do I want to share my life with such a creature? No answer. Perhaps all shall be well when she's in my bed. And my bank. Oh, my heart too, I hope. But the French lieutenant's woman makes me feel as if I'm missing something. As if I'm on a fixed voyage. And shouldn't be. Clap.
Sam, at that moment, was considering his problem with his fraction of Eve, who happened to be called Mary.
Well, what do we aim to be, Sam?
Not always a gentleman skivvy, that's for sure. I'll tell you straight what I want to be.
Go on then, tell us.
One day, I'm going to be a draper and an haberdasher.
With a shop that sells ribbons and things.
Yeah, I've never told no one afore. I can't pass an haberdasher shop without looking in the window.
Until your gentleman calls you out.
One day, mark my words, I'll be a draper and an haberdasher.
One day, pigs will fly.
Before then. Well, I dare say you've got a suitor.
None I really likes.
I ain't too bad, am I?
Oh, I never said he was.
I've known a lot of girls, all sorts. None like you.
Oh, nothing special about me.
Ain't there? That's what you think. I've never known one like you. Here, do you fancy seeing London?
London? Me?
Yeah, when they're married off upstairs, I'll show you London.
Oh, no, you wouldn't.
Cut off me arms, I would.
All my fashionable London girls. Oh, you wouldn't want to go walking out with me.
If you had the clothes, you'd do. You'd do very nice.
Oh, don't believe me.
Cross my heart. Here, give me your hand.
All right.
They did not need to speak any longer. And why, in the silence, Sam found Mary so understanding is a mystery no lover will need explaining.
These ash trees are incredible. They must be the largest in England. It is a primordial wood, whatever the awful Mrs. Pulteney may imagine it is. And as she has forbidden her staff to walk here and has her spy, perhaps Sarah Woodruff will take heed and walk elsewhere. I doubt it. She wishes to be martyred, I'm sure. There, this time, if I meet her, it must be a polite good day and walk on. I hope I'm keeping clear of where she haunts. Now, where is this? Well, the only way up is there. Tunnel of ivy, more or less. Right, here goes. Oh, there's sunlight ahead. And the wilderness.
I saw you pass earlier.
What? Where are you? Oh, there. Did I startle you?
No. I was waiting for you.
You were waiting for me? Why, Miss Woodruff?
I found these. Are they not fossilized sea urchins?
Yes, they are indeed. And in excellent condition.
Will you not take them?
Yes, I am most grateful. That's kind of you to have looked for them.
I had nothing better to do. I don't mean to appear ungracious.
No, you are not. I'm on the way back. Are you also?
I followed you. I should not have done.
I think it would be best if I went on my way.
No, please. Do you not see I have no one to turn to?
You know Miss Tranter would help.
She is kind. I do not need kindness.
I am told the Vicar of Lyme is a good man.
Yes. He found me employment with Mrs. Pulteney.
Miss Woodruff, you must realise it would be most improper of me to...
interest yourself further in me and my circumstances?
That must be obvious to both of us. All I can say is you should leave this town.
If I went to London, I know what I should become.
My dear Miss Woodruff, that is hardly... it would be...
I should become what some already call me in Lyme.
Why judge yourself so harshly? Why?
Because I am weak, Mr. Smithson. How should I know I am? Have I not sinned?
I think this must be the fear which keeps you in line.
In part it is. May I explain?
I am most sorry for you.
No, do not be, but let me explain myself.
I do not understand why you should seek to make me your confidant.
Do you not?
I think I should go on my way.
I will explain. Because you have travelled, because you are educated, because you are a gentleman, because... oh, I don't know how, because you are not like other people I live among. Those the world tells me are kind, pious, Christian people. And yet they seem more cruel than the most cruel heathens, stupider than the most stupid animals. I cannot believe that life is without understanding or compassion. It's not right that I should suffer so. I ask myself, why am I born what I am? Why am I not born a Miss Freeman?
That is a question better not asked. It cannot be answered.
I'm not envious. It's not envy.
Which could be forgiven in your case.
But incomprehension. Do you not see incomprehension that my life is as it is?
It is beyond my powers to help you there. It is beyond anyone's power.
No, I do not. I will not believe that.
But you must, my dear Miss Woodruff, you must.
No, I cannot. Will not. Now, I have annoyed you. I have contradicted you, and you are a man. I am merely a woman.
You have not annoyed me. You simply bewilder me. I do not know what you can expect from me. You must surely realize that any sort of intimacy between us is quite impossible.
Myself on your mercy in this way if I were not desperate.
Oh, I don't doubt your despair, but what can I do? What is it you want of me?
I should like to tell you what happened 18 months ago. What happened to me?
This is impossible. I cannot allow myself to.
I implore you. You must. You must.
Please, get up. Look, if we were to be seen...
Not until you say you will listen. I am not yet mad, but unless given help, I shall be.
Give me your hand. Now get to your feet. I am not indifferent to your troubles. But you must see, I have no choice.
But you are my last resource. And you would not be so cruel. I know you are not cruel. You are different to most. You understand what is beyond the understanding of anyone in line.
Now you flatter.
All I ask is that you meet me once more. That you listen to my story.
If I should, with the greatest reluctance...
You would do me such service I could never thank you enough.
I will do my best to see you once more.
I cannot find words to thank you. I shall be here on Wednesday and Friday afternoons. The sun is setting. I must not detain you longer.
Yes, of course. Good day, Miss Woodruff.
Well, now, will you look at that fish, Miss Freeman? Tell me what you make of it.
We've eaten it, Dr. Grogan.
Ah. It was a dressed salmon, was it not?
Was it, Charles, you ordered it?
It was the best the White Lion could summon up.
I thought it was a fine, plump fish, Charles.
There you are. Miss Tranter has said it. A plump salmon, well-dressed in all its finery. And now it lays there undressed, no longer either plump or attractive, as a warning to all men.
Dr. Grogan, I blush for you.
Dr. Grogan is a great shocker of the ladies at Lestina.
There is one I would like to shock more than any.
You cannot be referring to the lady of Marlborough House, can you, Grogan?
Oh, a doctor isn't allowed to do so.
That housekeeper of hers, Mrs. Fairley, follows her staff around when they're in line.
Mrs. Fairley
Nobody follows us all around the town. And reports back to her mistress everything she sees.
So would she follow Charles when he goes hunting for his old fossils?
Well, not if he ventures on Ware Common. You know, do you, that Mrs. Pulteney believes it to be haunted by French abominations?
I did explain to Charles that it was better if he kept his explorations to himself when we took tea at Marlborough House the other day.
Is the place haunted, Charles, by strange visions?
Well, I'm always too busy searching for my old fossils to see them if they are.
My girl Mary tells me that poor Miss Woodcraft did walk on the commons, but now has been forbidden to do so.
But will she obey her mistress' command?
I doubt it. And Mrs. Fairley will be at that dairy farm on the common's edge, waiting.
And poor Tragedy will not notice, for she notices neither man nor beast when she walks.
It is late, Ernestina. I think we should return. Then Mrs. Fairley will not be able to report on our unchristian acts.
And Smithson and I will see you safely to your door.
Oh, splendid.
Then you, Smithson, are to come to my house for a nightcap. Doctor's order.
Dr. Grogan was a dry little kestrel of an Irishman. He had studied at Heidelberg and practised in London, and knew the world and its absurdities as only an intelligent Irishman can, which is to say that when his knowledge or memory failed him, his imagination was always ready to fill the gap.
Are you by any chance interested in paleontology, Grogan?
It is not my subject. I think that when we know more of the living, that will be the time to pursue the dead.
I take your point. Your health.
Slums.
I was introduced the other day when at Marlborough House to a specimen of the local flora that inclines me partly to agree with you. A very strange case. Perhaps you know more of it than I do. Or is she a patient of yours and I am being indiscreet?
Oh, we know more about the fossils out there on the beach than we do about what takes place in that girl's mind.
I observed her discreetly, I hope. She seems not one of us.
A German doctor called Hartmann has recently divided melancholia into categories. Natural, that is born sad. Occasional, springing from a sad occasion. And obscure, which means he doesn't know what the devil causes it.
But she had occasion, did she not?
A sad occasion. But is she the first young woman to be jilted? I could tell you of a dozen others here in line.
But she was brutally jilted, was she not?
So it is said. But I have known worse. And today they're as merry as crickets. I'll tell you this, in strictest confidence, you understand.
Yes, of course.
I was called to see her 10 months ago. She was weeping without cause, could hardly speak, and had a look about the eyes which was tragic. Melancholia, as plain as measles.
She was then at Marlborough House.
She was. So I thought the cause was plain. 6 weeks, 6 days at that place is enough to drive any normal person into Bethlehem. I should like to see that place of piety burnt to the ground and its owner with it. I'd dance a jig on the ashes, I swear I would.
I think I might well join you.
I did what I could for the girl, saw to it that she had 2 afternoons a week to herself. But I was sure there was only one cure.
To get her away from Lyme?
And as soon as possible. Now, a fortnight later, Grogan sees her walking towards the cob past his house. So he has her in and talks to her, is as gentle with her as if she's his favourite niece. He must leave Lyme, says Grogan, to sum it up. And it was like jumping a jarvie over a 10-foot wall. Not on. Oh, didn't she show Grogan the not on?
Do you think... Does she enjoy the misery?
Oh, sure, sure. But one other unusual thing is that it seems she has had a softening effect on Mrs. Pulteney. The servants stay on. And I visited a sick undermaid there to find our Miss Woodruff very much in control. Look, how do you account for that, Mr. Smithson?
Well, only that she must have a very strong character beneath her tragic exterior, a strong mind, even though it is crippled by melancholy.
Ah, very good. But she won't leave Lyme. She loves it here. The good Dr. Hartmann describes similar cases. He says, it is as if the woman becomes addicted to melancholia, as one becomes addicted to opium. Yes. there it is, Smithson. Her sadness becomes her happiness. She wants to be the sacrificial victim. Where you and I flinch back, she leaps forward. She is possessed by melancholia. It's dark indeed. Very, very dark.
If, let us say, she could bring herself to reveal the feelings she is hiding to some sympathetic person...
Oh, she would probably be cured. But she does not want to be cured. She refuses to take the medicine.
But with medicine you would be
able to... Oh, how do you force the soul, young man?
Oh, there is no way you can.
And it is better so. Understanding never grew from violation.
Then she is a hopeless case?
Medicine can do nothing. You must not think she is like us men, able to reason clearly, able to examine her motives, to understand why she behaves as she does. One must see her as a woman in a mist. All we can do is wait and hope that the mists rise. Then, perhaps... Perhaps.
The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles was dramatised by Frederick Bradnam, directed by Janet Whittaker, and starred Amanda Redman as Sarah Woodruff and David Threlfall as Charles Smithson. Also featuring were Norman Rodway, Teresa Gallagher, Jason Fleming, Margaret Courtney, Jill Graham, Jilly Mears, Steve Hodson, Una Beeson, Barry J. Gordon, and Rachel Adkins.